Now, what's going to happen in most churches this morning is that a preacher is going to come up and he's going to share the entire story of the resurrection, of Jesus' sacrifice, his crucifixion, the hands of the Romans and the Jewish authorities, and then his resurrection. We're going to do things a little bit differently. And oftentimes, at the end of that message, the preacher might kind of give a little bit of an emotional story, something that will tug at your heartstrings a little bit. And if there's a live worship band, we obviously don't have that, but if there are musicians, oftentimes they'll kind of just play some soft, quiet, emotional music underneath the story to really tug at your heart by the end of the message. And that's okay. That works for some people, but we're going to take a different approach this morning. Because I would like to appeal not at your emotions and not at your heart, but to your mind, to your logic, and to your reasoning. And to be upfront, obviously, I believe that the resurrection is an actual historic event that happened. Without that, there's no reason to believe in anything. But my motivation today isn't necessarily that you would walk away from this service believing in Jesus or calling yourself a Christian or saying, this is the church I want to be a part of. My motivation is to just get you to start asking questions, regardless of what you believe, whether you consider yourself a Christian or, as I like to say, a follower of Jesus, because Christian has somewhat lost its meaning, or you consider yourself an atheist, or, nah, my family went to church, but it's not really for me, or, honestly, I don't even really know what I believe. Regardless of those things, we can all start asking ourselves questions. And there's this topic that's been floating around the internet, especially for the last several years, called deconstruction. Spiritual deconstruction, or Christian deconstruction, or deconstructing your faith. And this is basic idea. Oftentimes, it's people will start to have questions about their faith, questions about church, about Christianity, about Jesus, or maybe an entirely different spiritual set of beliefs or religions. And they're faced with these questions and they kind of just start picking apart at it. And oftentimes those questions aren't answered. And it just leaves them to walk away from their faith. Maybe walk away from the church, walk away from organized religion, or walk away from Jesus. But deconstruction isn't necessarily a bad thing. Because if any of you know my story, I grew up in the church. I grew up a pastor's son. I was very ingrained in Christian and even religious culture. But once I became an adult, I went down this path of, I had all these questions. I had doubts. I had concerns. Sometimes the things that I saw Christians do didn't line up with what I know Jesus said. And so I entered a phase of spiritual deconstruction where I took everything that I knew or everything that I thought I knew, everything that I believed, everything I had been told, and I started to break it apart, examine it, look at all these things for what they actually are, question everything. I'm a very skeptical person, and to my fault, this isn't a good thing. I can also be a very cynical person. But I began to break it apart, but the result of that was not walking away from Jesus. I walked away from a lot of things. I walked away from a lot of things that are considered Christian or religious culture. But my faith in Jesus remained. In fact, that's the only thing that I claim to know 100%. Politics, no. Science, no. Like anything else, I don't know, and I'm okay with not knowing and continuing to grow. My opinions about certain issues and matters, they'll likely change as I grow and as I experience new things, and that's a good thing. But my faith in the identity of Jesus, a historical figure that changed the world and shaped all of Western civilization, that is stronger than ever. And my hope is that if you enter that phase, you could have a similar result. And maybe you won't. Maybe it'll look completely different, and that's okay. I'm willing to just trust God with the process. So this morning, as we begin, this is a three-part conversation. We're going to be talking about deconstruction for the next three Sundays. But today we're just going to be posing the question, why do you believe? And I have 5 points that I'd like to share with you all today just about the topic of deconstruction. And the first point is this. We are all people of faith. Now, depending on your background, you might want to hesitate, push back a little bit. Let's look at what the definition of faith is. I looked this up and there's two different definitions that I really liked. One is it's a complete trust or confidence in someone or something. Now, the definition is a firm belief in something for which there is no proof. We all have faith in something. You all came here today because you had faith that you weren't going to get in a horrible car accident on your way here. You probably didn't think about that, but if that was your concern, if you really thought that, you know what, I probably won't make it to the church alive, I hope you would have said, I'm not going, because I don't want that to happen to any of you. But you all had faith. A couple of years ago, we all had this blind faith that life would just continue on as we know it, that society would continue to function as normal. And then spring of 2020 happened and everything was flipped upside down and we realized how futile that faith was. That anything can change in a second. You have faith that whatever you believe about the world, about yourself, about science, about nature, about religion, about God, about politics, that the things you were told were true. You just trust the authority of others, and that's not a bad thing. But the question I want to pose to you, and the question, honestly, I want you to pose to yourself, is why do we believe the things that we believe? Because we all believe in something. And when we refuse to question our beliefs, when we refuse to examine them, the reasons behind them, and how it impacts our lives, there's a danger that we could become victims of harmful ideologies. That we could allow things that we think are true, that maybe aren't true, to shape the way, especially that we treat others. And if you believe something that causes you to mistreat someone, that's not something that's worth believing. 1 John 4:1 says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world." So if you're a follower of Jesus, if you consider yourself a Christian, we have no choice. We have to test the things that we believe. Because there are false beliefs and ideas out there. We can't let ourselves become victim to them. Maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe you're not a believer. There's still fake news out there. There's still harmful beliefs and ideologies. You need to test them. We know that people are trying to intentionally deceive us. And that's not a dig at any one political side or whatever. It's a dig at both of them, honestly. Everyone has an agenda. There is a motivation behind every news article and story that is shared with us. We have to examine them so that we don't fall victim to false beliefs. And for the Christians, we are expected to mature in faith. The problem that often happens with followers of Jesus in the church is that they make a decision, I'm going to give my life to Jesus, I'm coming to him in faith, and then they never grow. They never mature. Honestly, if you read the teachings and the instructions of Paul to the early church, he warns against getting new, immature believers really involved in something because their faith hasn't matured enough to a point where they can fully understand everything that they believe and why they believe it. Ephesians 4:14 Paul wrote, then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning of craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. So people aren't sure what you believe. I highly recommend you take a second look at the things you believe. But those of you who follow Jesus, it's not optional. You need to examine your faith. And now, if you've grown up in a church, this you might be a little hesitant about talking about deconstruction, as many churches are, but despite what you have heard, point two, questions are not the enemy of belief. Questions are not the enemy of your faith. Questions are not the enemy of what, of how you view yourself and the world around you. Unanswered questions can lead people to walk away from their faith. And again, I say faith as whichever way you define it, whether you consider yourself spiritual, religious, whatever. Unanswered questions is one that doubt can fester inside. Unanswered questions lead people to walk away from their faith. And this is where the church has often gotten it wrong. Many churches. Because people will start to have real adult questions, mature questions about their beliefs, about our traditions, about why they believe certain things. And too many people are afraid to answer that. The one cliche that I cannot stand is the Bible says it, that settles it. What that means is I don't really have the answer for you and I don't want to get into it right now. But we need to create an environment where people can ask their questions and engage in helpful dialogue and helpful discussion without fear of judgment and of being shut down. And I tell my friends know this, I'll answer any question that you have. And I don't always have the answers because I'm not expected to know all the answers. But I'll look into it. I'll come back. I'll think about it myself, figure out what I believe about whatever that is. I'll get back to you. Or even better, let's look into it together. Let's talk about this. So when people have questions and the church isn't willing to answer, that leaves them one option, to walk away. And in some cases, we've just created an environment where people feel like if they have questions, that immediately means they have no faith. But that's not true. Having questions does not mean that you don't have faith. Having questions means that you want to dig in deeper, and that's a good thing, and that should be encouraged. And if you do read the words of the followers and friends of Jesus who wrote about his life, you know, Jesus welcomes questions and responds to doubts. Jesus welcomes people's questions. I love the original 12 followers of Jesus because they were just like you and I. They had no idea what was happening. They spent day and night traveling around the world with Jesus, and they did not understand. They did not get what he was doing. They didn't really fully understand who he was. The real reason why a lot of people chose to follow Jesus during his ministry was because they thought that he was an earthly king. So they thought that he was going to overthrow the Roman Empire because the Jewish people at that time were under oppression by the Romans. And so they thought that here he is, here's our king. He's going to make everything better. And they honestly followed him because they thought they would have like a position of royalty. They even asked like, hey, can I sit on either side of you on the throne? They didn't know what he was doing. And constantly they asked questions. And people say there are no stupid questions. Read the things that Peter asked. Peter is hilarious. He's always asking questions. Jesus would tell this amazing story, and then Peter would be like, huh? can you explain that to me again? And Jesus would explain to it. He didn't ridicule them for asking questions. He would go on to explain. He might have a little wink in the eye. He might, you know, say something a little bit sarcastic to Peter. But he would respond to their questions. And there's this incredible story. This happened after Jesus was resurrected. After Jesus came back from the dead. It's important to note that the followers of Jesus did not think he was coming back from the dead. They thought he was dead and that he would do what every other dead person did. Stay dead. In fact, some of the followers, some of the women who followed Jesus, they went to just kind of help like prepare Jesus' body for burial. And that's when they showed up a couple days later and his body's gone. And their first reaction wasn't what we might think, hallelujah, he raised from the dead. No, they're like, who took Jesus' body? Because they weren't expecting this. But Jesus appeared to them and they saw with their very own eyes that he was alive. And then Jesus showed up in a locked room because the followers of Jesus at this time were no longer followers of Jesus. They thought it was over and they were hiding for their lives because they thought what the officials did to Jesus, they were next. So they're hiding in this locked room, afraid of the Jewish officials and afraid of the Romans, when all of a sudden Jesus pops up. And they see with their very own eyes that he's alive. Now, one of the 12 disciples, one of the original 12, Thomas, wasn't there. He wasn't in the room at the time. So he ends up coming back and meeting with all these people. And they tell him, dude, Jesus is alive. And he didn't believe it. In fact, so this is Thomas, also known as Didymus, that just means twin, not important. One of the 12 was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Now, because of this, Christian tradition has been a little bit harsh on Thomas. They gave him the nickname of Doubting Thomas. But if that defines who he is, then call me Doubting David. If you were to tell me someone was alive, I again would think that you're pulling a sick prank. Probably what Thomas thought that they were doing. He said, no, no, no. Unless I see for myself, how do you expect me to believe? A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side, where the spear had pierced him. Stop doubting and believe. And it's easy for us to look at this kind of as a condemnation from Jesus, but it wasn't. He's just encouraging them, join your brothers. Because like they saw me, now you have seen me too. Thomas said, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And again, that's not a dig at Thomas. Because Jesus never expected people to believe in him based on blind faith. If that's what he wanted, he would have just disappeared to heaven. His body would have just been gone. And he would have just hoped that they would believe, but he didn't. He spent weeks appearing in front of so many people who had seen him die, like, hey, I'm here. From the very beginning, Jesus provided actual evidence that his believers may place their faith in, not just blind faith. Third point I want to share is deconstruction can lead to a more informed and focused faith. The problem that we face is that these events that we read about, this event that we're celebrating, happened 2,000 years ago. That's a long time. A lot of history has happened in the last 2,000 years. And the problem is the natural instinct of humans, and you know this, is to mess everything up. And not always on purpose, but it's just what we do. How often have any of you just found yourself saying, man, I just screw up everything I touch, don't I? It's natural. We're only human. And so the faith that Jesus has given us in, or has given us to us, we've altered it. We've corrupted it. Sometimes unintentionally, but unfortunately, sometimes intentionally. Some people have weaponized this faith and turned it into a religion. People often will make comments about, I'm religious or whatever, and I just, it's too much to explain in that moment. But if you actually know what Jesus said, he wasn't here to start a religion. In fact, the only people Jesus fought with while he was alive was the religious people. But as humans, our instinct was to turn it into a religion. Jesus had no commandments other than love your neighbor as yourself and follow me. But we've added all these laws and regulations. We've gatekeeped this belief in order to control others and advance our own will. That's why deconstruction is so important. Because there are some things many of us consider to be a key part of Christianity that actually isn't. It's man-made. It's human ideas. It's flawed beliefs. It's political agendas. That's why we have to take this thing that we call Christianity and break it apart and look back at the words of Jesus and say, is this actually a part of it? Because if it isn't, it's harmful. It's hurting others. It's dividing the church. It's making it to the point that outsiders don't want to be a part of this because it doesn't really seem like we know what we're for anymore. So we need to deconstruct. And the term Christian, lots of people have applied it to their own lives, but I just want to tell you, family history is not a good enough reason to call yourself a Christian. Oh, my grandmother was religious, so I guess that makes us Christian. No. My family goes to church on Easter and Christmas, so yeah, I'm a Christian. I went to Sunday school. I was confirmed if you're a Catholic. Was baptized as a baby. So yeah. If you're forcing me to click a check mark, then yeah, I'm Christian. Or I'm a white American, so that means I'm a Christian. These are not good enough reasons to call yourself a Christian or follower of Jesus, because being a Christian is a personal decision that you must make for yourself. And let me just tell you, not enough pastors say this. There are things at stake. Being a follower of Jesus is going to cost you something. So don't just take the name in vain. Don't just flippantly consider yourself a Christian. It's a big deal. It's a decision you have to make. It's estimated that 31% of the world's population, some studies that I read, I think they're up to date, identify themselves as Christians, that they were just asked to fill out a box and like, yeah, I'm a Christian. I guarantee you, 31% of the world's population are not following Jesus. Because if the thing that defines a Christian is that they obey Jesus' one commandment, love others the way that I loved you. If 31% of the world's population did that, the world would look drastically different. If 31% of the population actually treated each other with love first before anything else, why would anyone resist? It wouldn't just be 31%. It'd be 100%, because who doesn't want to be a part of a community like that? But too many people call themselves a Christian without actually knowing why and what they believe. And it's led to the reputation that the church has is convoluted history. People pick out things like, okay, but the Crusades, or okay, but corruption in the church, okay, but the people who stand in street corners and yell at everyone that they're going to hell and that God hates them. Because people don't actually know what it is that they believe. And again, if you look at the words of Jesus and you read the words of his first followers, Jesus and his earliest followers advocated for deconstruction. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Take what you believe. Break it apart. And examine, is this actually what Jesus said? And do I actually believe these things? Jesus himself said, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. I believe without a shadow of a doubt that if you enter this journey of actually seeking answers, not just posing questions, but seeking truth, that God will be faithful enough to provide you with the answers, as he did with Thomas. Thomas said, I need this evidence to believe, and Jesus said, okay, here you go. So that's why I believe if you're not a Christian or a follower of Jesus or whatever, that if you actually start, I'm not afraid of you coming out the other side of spiritual this deconstruction, believing something else. Because I believe the truth is out there. And I believe that if you earnestly look for the answers, you're going to find them. And this is just my opinion. So don't get too offended. It's just my opinion. But I believe the American church needs to enter a period of spiritual deconstruction. I believe the American church needs to take a good, hard look in the mirror and say, are we actually saying what we believe? Are we actually doing what we believe? Do we actually know what we believe? And if you've been resistant to the church, or anyone listening online who doesn't like church, doesn't like Christians, I think you'll like this next part. But I need to be honest with those of us who call ourselves Christians. We have filtered the words of Jesus through our own self-serving ideologies. We have used our God-given freedom to advance our own rights, our own interests, rather than promote and serve the needs of others as Jesus commanded. We have taken the name of Christ in vain to win income and elections, rather than win souls. Jesus said moments before he died, by this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Is that how we're known today? Honestly. For those of you who are outside the church, is that how you view us? When you log onto Facebook or Twitter, is that how people are talking about Christians? Because the first followers of Jesus, they got it right. That's how people viewed them. And that's why people wanted to be a part of it, despite the fact that they were murdered for it. It was too irresistible. They're weird. They're crazy. They believe some wild things. But look at how they treat others. I want to be a part of that. We've lost our way. And we need to deconstruct, many of us. But I want to give a point of warning. You have to be careful. Because deconstruction is better done with a screwdriver than a hammer. If you have a valuable object that is broken, your first instinct, hopefully, isn't to go after it with a hammer. Why? You're just going to make matters worse. You're going to break it. What are you going to be left with? Broken pieces and a mess, and you didn't solve anything. But if it's valuable enough that you want to try to fix it, use a screwdriver. You take it apart. You examine the pieces. You figure out what parts are broken, what parts need to be discarded, what parts need to be replaced, and what parts need to remain there. This is obvious. I don't think anyone's going to be surprised by this next statement, but a screwdriver deconstructs. A hammer destroys. If you use it to destroy. Your faith, again, however you define it, just the way that you view yourself, your own personal identity, the world around you, that is so valuable. Regardless of what you believe, that's what makes you, you. That's what defines how you live your life and how you treat others and how you view your hopes and dreams. That is too valuable to be smashed with a hammer. And too often when you hear people talking about deconstruction, they're not deconstructing. They're destructing. They're demolishing. And what happens? They're left angry and confused. They're left with a bunch of broken pieces and nothing is solved. They're left worse off than they were before. That's not the goal. You want to come through that tunnel feeling better than you did before. That's why you need to be careful. Last point. The ramifications of the story of Jesus are too great to be ignored. Maybe you're not sure what you believe. I just want to pose a simple question. If it's true, if a man, a day laborer turned rabbi, who was murdered by the Roman Empire, actually came back and appeared to people after his death, wouldn't that change things? Wouldn't that change how you view yourself? How you view the world? How you view others? How you just view life and death in general? So many people were convinced of its truth and its accuracy that they were able to die for it. Don't you owe it to yourself to take a deeper look? Maybe you'll look at it and you'll say, you know what, I still don't believe. That's okay. But you owe it to yourself to examine. And I understand that a lot of us are hesitant. I love this quote from Andy Stanley. This is paraphrase. I try to remember it the best way he said. He said, if the version of Christianity you grew up with didn't seem like good news, then you grew up with the wrong version. So many of us grew up with a version of Christianity or see a version of Christianity that it does not seem like good news. So why would I even want to start asking those questions? But to the first followers of Jesus, it was such good news that they were willing to die for it. Horrible deaths. They didn't gain anything on earth. They sold their possessions. They treated people who mistreated them with love and they forgave them. Who would do that? Why would you do that? Other religious beliefs, if you look at their history, the people who promoted those beliefs is because they gained something on earth. They gained some type of worldly possession or renown or money or whatever. It satisfied their human cravings. That did not happen to the first followers of Jesus who were murdered by the Roman Empire, who were stoned outside of the gates of their cities, who were burned on fire. Why would they continue to believe that in the face of such danger and death and destruction if they knew that it wasn't true? Now, let's be clear. Wanting something to be true doesn't necessarily make it true, right? We all know that. And that's not what Christianity is about. It's not just wanting it to be true, so, you know, I'll believe it. I want processed sugar to be good for my life. I want doctors to come out and say, you can eat as much sugar as you want and nothing bad will happen to you. That doesn't make it true. But if you don't want something to be true, then you're going to be resistant to it, right? I don't want to believe that it's true. And so I just want to encourage you to start actually looking at the words that Jesus said, because it was good news for everyone. And if you're resistant to it, it's probably because you don't see it as good news. But it was good news to everyone. In fact, the only people who rejected the message of Jesus were the religious elite who used laws and tradition and beliefs as a weapon to control others. That was the only people in the first century who rejected it. And if you don't like Christians, I guarantee you don't like religious elite people. But to everyone else, it was good news. To everyone else, it meant that you were forgiven and there's nothing you have to do. There are no laws. There's not traditions you have to follow. There's no commandments that you have to obey. He forgave you before you even asked for it. And there's nothing you can do to deserve it, because it's freely given. How is that not good news? When presented in its raw and original context, the message of Jesus is good news for every person on earth. It was such good news, again, that the followers of Jesus were willing to die for it. So we have to ask ourselves, is there any truth to it? Now, if you want to dig deeper into this, I have to tell you, you can't come to an informed conclusion about the identity of Jesus without reading the testimonies of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I got to tell you, these are separate documents. The unfortunate thing is that we now view the Bible as one book. It's not. It's a collection of ancient documents, some ancient Jewish scriptures, some letters by the followers of Jesus, and eyewitness testimonies about the life of Jesus collected together. So you can't say, well, I don't like this one thing in the Bible, so that means I don't like any of it. No. It's like reading a newspaper. You don't like one article. Guess what? There's other journalists. Doesn't mean everything in it is wrong. Doesn't mean anything is it you have to hesitate against. So we have to ask if these documents that people are willing to die for have any truth to them. And if they do, then come on, that's a game changer. You gotta read the only documents that have survived today, again, because people were burning these letters and murdering the people who wrote them. We have to read these if you want a greater understanding of who Jesus is. And if you're new to the Bible, if you're new to Scripture, I just want to give you a quick breakdown of what these are. The Gospel of Matthew is a documentation of how Jesus fulfilled the ancient Jewish prophecies and scriptures. Matthew was a tax collector. The Jews hated him, but Jesus invited him to follow him anyways. He was with Jesus throughout his entire ministry. And later, he wrote this as a letter to other Jewish people, picking apart these ancient Jewish scriptures and literature and saying, see, he did this. See, he did this. See, he did this. The Gospel of Mark. Mark wasn't one of the original followers of Jesus. He began to follow Jesus after his death, but he went around with Paul. You guys all know Paul and Peter. And the Gospel of Mark is likely the written account of Peter's perspective of the life of Jesus. Now, Peter, as you know, probably know, was a fisherman. He was also most likely illiterate. He could not write the story by himself. So he needed someone to document it for him, document the things that he saw. And that's where Mark came in. And the Gospel of Mark is the shortest gospel, and it's all action. It's what you would expect from a fisherman telling a story. The Gospel of Luke. Personally, this is my favorite gospel. Luke was a doctor. He again followed Jesus after the events of the resurrection. He heard the news. He begins it. It's a letter to some wealthy believer, and it's a thorough investigation of the events of the life of Jesus using specific details and eyewitness accounts. If you read the Gospel of Luke, you'll be like, why did he include so many things? That's because he was rewriting it to someone who knew these people, knew these events, knew these places. He's pretty much challenging whoever's reading it, fact check me, I dare you. In the Gospel of John, John is one of the followers of Jesus during his life, and he's honestly probably Jesus' best friend. He knew him better than anyone else, and has the greatest explanation and understanding of the nature of Jesus, written by the man who probably knew him the best. He was the first person in human history to ever utter the words, God is love. Said after watching Jesus, after watching what he did, after hearing his words, the only conclusion I can come to about God is that he is love. It's important to note that sometimes people who don't really know what they believe, but they consider themselves spiritual, you'll ask them, okay, well, what is God? Well, God is love. You know, God is love. That only exists in this context. That's a Christian idea. That's a Jesus idea, and it originated with this. So I encourage you, read these books. I don't want to meddle a little bit. I have some questions that I want you to take home. I want you to research. I want you to wrestle with. These are the questions, honestly, that I ask myself and why I have the faith in Jesus that I do. First question, how did ancient Jewish texts written hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus correctly predict specific details surrounding the life and death of Jesus? This is extraordinary if you know history. How was Jesus able to prophesy the destruction of the Jewish temple 40 years before it happened? The Jewish temple was this amazing monument with stones that are massive, virtually impossible for anyone to think that it could be destroyed. But he said, no. Every stone in this building is going to be overturned and thrown down that mountain. Not one will be left standing. And people were furious. That's one of the reasons why the Jewish people want to kill him, because that was blasphemy and it's impossible. Fast forward 40 years, Jewish zealots tried to rebel against the Roman Empire. Not really a great idea considering the massive size and resources of the Romans. And they go through and they wipe out the city. And they used so many men and horses and tools to destroy the building and toss the stones. In fact, if you go to Jerusalem, those massive stones are still there because they can't be moved. How on earth did Jesus predict that so specifically and correctly? We've talked about this, but what would cause the same group of men and women who betrayed, denied, disavowed and abandoned Jesus at the moment of his death to later willingly be persecuted, beaten, jailed, and murdered to spread the news of an upside down, backwards, sacrificial, self-denying, others first kingdom? What would cause them to do so? Again, they did not really gain anything. It wasn't like they're saying, hey, Jesus said that you have to give me money. In fact, no, all the first followers of Jesus sold all their possessions and gave it to the poor. Why would you be willing to die for that? And this is history's greatest mystery. I want you to know, I love reading books by atheists. I do. It's interesting to hear their perspectives, and it's interesting trying to hear their explanation. I just read an entire book of an atheist first century scholar who tried to answer this question, and his conclusion was, I don't know. History's greatest mystery. No one can answer this unless you actually think the event of the resurrection happened, okay? How and why did a tiny, outlawed Jewish sect of followers of a crucified carpenter turned rabbi, birthed in the armpit of the Roman Empire, defy death and expand to become the leading belief system in the empire that once attempted to destroy it. And mind you, this all happened before the creation of the Bible. A lot of scholars, they say, well, it was the Bible. No, it expanded so much that Constantine, the year 300-something, ended up legalizing Christianity because there were so many Christians. He couldn't even stop it at that point. So what happened in those first 300 years? How on earth did it grow to be the size that it was? That later on, he legalized it and he actually funded Christian scholars to come out of the caves, come out of the holes they're hiding with these sacred documents that they had given up their lives to protect, read them and organize them and bind them in what we now know as the Bible. How on earth did that happen? I went to Italy a few months ago, traveled around Rome. There's crosses everywhere. There's statues of Jesus and his disciples everywhere. There's massive, gorgeous, beautiful cathedrals in the same city that once murdered them. But the same government that crucified him. The point of crucifixion is to wipe you away from history. We don't know the names of any other person who was ever crucified because it's so shameful. It's saying this person is disgusting. This person is worthless. How on earth did the story and reputation of Jesus survive that when no one else did? How many Jewish rabbis from the first century do you know the names of? There's lots. How many carpenters for the first century do you know the name of? Pilate, the Jewish official, or the Roman official who oversaw the death of Jesus? We don't even know that much about him because even he has faded from history. But the story of Jesus remained. How on earth? Again, maybe the result of asking these questions at the end of the tunnel, maybe it'll look different than mine. Maybe you'll come out the other side saying, I investigated it. I looked into it, David. Thanks for those resources. Thanks for those tips. I just still don't believe it. You know what? That's okay. Because at least you did the work. At least you looked into it. But I believe if we ask, if we seek, and if we knock, that Jesus will be faithful to answer our questions and respond to our doubts. Now, I'm not just going to leave you with this. On our website, lampsonroad.church/deconstruct, we have compiled a list of resources that are valuable to answering these questions. Different tips and videos and books and everything. I'm going to keep adding to it because there's other stuff that I want to add to it. But I encourage you to look into those things and dig deeper. If you have questions, please ask me. I love talking about this stuff. This is what I'm really devoting my life to. But you owe it to yourself to find out if there's any truth to it. Maybe there isn't. You owe it to yourself to find out. Another thing to help you, free screwdrivers. They're out on the table. As you leave, you can pick one up. Little portable screwdrivers has our website on it. Just as a reminder that when you're faced with questions and when you're faced with doubts, don't abandon them. Don't let them fester. Don't destroy them. Deconstruct. Dig deeper. And next week, we're going to continue our conversation, and I'm going to be sharing a bunch of the main reasons why people walk away from the faith and why they don't need to be part of it to begin with. I hope you'll join us for that.